Hey everybody, welcome to the Daily Friend, the Friday edition, the weekly roundup, where I have colleagues in studio and we're going to chat about the topical stuff that happened in the week. And this episode will have a particular focus on the economy, because I think a lot of you, if I watch the comments and some of the interactions we've been having online, are particularly worried around the state of things and the confusion that we're seeing from not only the ANC, but also the myriad of mainstream media pundits and journalists who seem to be downplaying this as just another spat in the ANC. And no one sees the significance of what's happening. Speaking about the significance of what's happening and the real solid analysis, you'll find that on the Daily Friend website at dailyfriend.co.za. All of our writers are on there. Solid analysis, good news pieces, and edited by our very Saragon, who you guys know as being a regular feature on the show. I'm not alone. I have a special, special panel with me today. I'm going to start from the end and work my way in. We've got Gabriel Krauser, who's one of our writers and analysts here at the Institute of Race Relations. Good morning.
Morning, Sihle.
And we have, of course, the head honcho himself, Frans Krenier. Good day, sir.
Sihle. Hello.
Hello, hello. And a special new face, I think, for a lot of us on the Daily Friend, Mr. Ian Cruickshanks, who's the head of economic policy at the Center for Risk Analysis. Excuse me. How are you doing, good sir?
Very well. And this must be a special occasion. You referred to me as Mr.
Oh, there you go. lots of respect being accorded on the show. That's how we roll. Fellas, it's been a roller coaster week in terms of the political rhetoric and just really the shenanigans from those within the elite in this country on messages of the economy front. I'm going to segue to you first just to set the agenda as to really what we saw this week and how much of a cluster mess it is.
Yes. No, it is that, Sihle. I mean, let's recap quickly. We start the week with economic growth data that shows the stagnation over the year, contraction quarter on quarter. That evening, the ANC has a press conference and their Secretary General announces that the party will proceed to investigate a policy that he calls quantity easing, which is essentially the manufacturing of money. In the aftermath of that, a whole lot of things happen. The finance minister, the head of economic policy at the ANC, two people, they come out and kind of suggest that this isn't what the ANC intends to do. On the back of that, the Communist Party, which commands now much of the cabinet, comes out with a comment saying that, no, in fact, this is something that we would consider doing. Following that, there's a to and fro between them, and this goes on for a couple of days. Remember that these two, the finance minister and the head of economic policy, Enoch Godongwana, are both probably on the way out. The minister's reluctant. We're told he was late for his parliamentary swearing-in, which suggests that you're not 100% focused on the job. And Godongwana has long been making noises that he's going to go as well. So the two relative pragmatists out. But on the other hand, remember that Godongwana, as pragmatic as he is also recently come out in favor of prescribed assets. Exactly. And so these things aren't as clear-cut as the media makes them out to be. Cyril Ramaphosa... Then the governor of the bank is said to have said that the barbarians are at the gate.
Yes.
His quote with regard to monetary policy. We've skipped through a few other comments along the way. Ramaphosa himself comes out with a statement in which he says the following. It is our desire for the Reserve Bank to be publicly owned. In other words, we want to nationalize it. However, we realize that this will come at a cost, which given our current and fiscal situation is simply not prudent. That means he agrees that they want to nationalize the bank. It's not what the media is reporting, that he has firmly put his foot down. This sycophantic gramophoria has got to the point that analysts can no longer understand English. Mm. Mm. He said, we do want to. It's just a question of the timing. The consequences, I'm sure Ian's going to take us into, but when I sat down for my breakfast meeting this morning, well, yesterday evening at dinner, we were at $14.99. When I sat down for breakfast, we were at $15.03. By the time I left breakfast, we were at $15.10, and we're somewhere north of that on the currency at the moment, so the consequences are there.
the consequences are there. We're seeing it in the numbers. Ian, I'm going to bring you in here for a moment because I think the numbers is often the part where people sort of glaze over. But we're now seeing a real-world effect. Not that we haven't before, but it's very pronounced now, where the numbers are beginning to track the rhetoric from the ruling party ever more pronounced. What do you have for us, Ian? Talk us through it.
What do we see? What does it really mean to us? What we see primarily is a weakening of the rand exchange rate against major currencies. As Francis said, it's going up by so many percent on a daily basis. Mm. What does that mean? It means that everything we import is getting more expensive every day. What's that going to do to the cost of living? What's it going to be to those people who are currently unemployed and struggling to put bread on the table? It's going to be even more difficult. I think where are we going? We're going to the possibility of a social uprising, and I think that government will have to do something about it. What can they do? They're going to have to import. They're going to have to have greater social grants. That is where their revenue is going to go. Got to keep people alive after all. And I think that means there'll be very little going into infrastructure development and helping the economy to get going sooner rather than later.
I'm going to open the question up. I want to pose something to the three of you because it became part of the debate this week, but really very shallow analysis in the mainstream media on it. The South African Reserve Bank. Regardless of what your view is on central banking, I have my own views on this, but anyway, we have someone at the helm there who, whatever you say, has held the line against ideologues within the government and within political parties. He has held the line, often in a very unpopular way. The Reserve Bank Governor, Lesego Kganyago, what is his role, Ian, excuse me, what is his role in terms of him being the Reserve Bank governor, and what is the role of the bank? And then I'm going to go to you chaps to talk about the assault, verbal at the moment, and rhetoric, really, against him.
His role is to make sure that government policy, which is written down in the Constitution,
yes,
is to maintain, for the Reserve Bank to maintain the value of the rand against international currencies, and to lead to lead to a growth policy in due course. Mm. I think that sums it up.
Value of the rand, that is a very important thing, isn't it?
Yes,
a lot of people
is.
Sort of say, oh, that's just for the rich, you know. Inflation is not really a big thing. It's just something the rich worry about. No. They're wrong, aren't they, Ian?
No, absolutely not. We have, South Africa has a high predilection for importing goods that may or may not be able to be produced here. The cost of imports is going up all the time, and that gets to the cost of living of every person, whether they're rich or poor or whatever. The cost of food, of transport, and so on is all getting more expensive. It makes for an uncertain, imbalanced economy.
Look, if I can just weigh in here.
Yeah.
The thing is that we can all be billionaires overnight. It happened in 1930s Germany. It happened in Zimbabwe.
It happened
in Venezuela now. People are billionaires, trillionaires, gazillionaires. But that's not actually what you want.
Yes.
You don't want to print money to the point that it's worth nothing. You wipe out middle class savings. You wipe out the sort of working class's ability to enjoy any wealth or accumulate any wealth. So I think Letsego Kganyago's attitude, both on the question of socialism or printing out money to the point where everyone's a billionaire, is unpopular, but he's held the line. And I think it's connected to his attitude towards race. Mm. Remember, he said a month or two ago that race baiting is the last vestige of the scoundrel.
Absolutely.
And he was saying it in regards to the EFF in particular, to the fact that they looted the VBS bank almost certainly, and they are exactly the party that proclaims its desire to fulfill the interests of working class and unemployed black South Africans, and yet they're the party that takes the money, and then when criticism comes their way, what do they say? Don't look at us. Look at the white people. Mm. Find a scapegoat. Mm. And Lesego Kganyago sees through that, and I think that makes him a very important, because of his position in power, that makes him a very important enemy to both socialists and race nationalists. And I think that the efforts to discredit him are only just beginning. In fact, people in the Reserve Bank told me last year that already there were moves were being made to discredit both him and the bank's mandate. And I think that that'll keep going as long as the ANC's policies make this country poorer, because the bottom line is, when your policies aren't doing what they're supposed to do, the easiest shortcut to take at some point or another, and it's inevitable when policies don't work, is to try and print money to get yourself out of the hole.
Franz, there's a bigger debate here, though. There's a bigger discussion here, and Gabriel's actually opening it up quite nicely in terms of there is now a large contingent, a concerted effort, if you will. Some of them, you know, form a weird coalition of the wounded, you know, because they were left out of cabinet or whatever the case may be, who are coalescing around a message of destroying the very institutions that safeguard not only the value of the rand and its implications for all South Africans, but other institutions really that form the economic bulwark that can, if we were to reform, grow the economy, create the jobs. We're seeing this messaging being very pronounced now, i.e. the Magashule et al.
I don't know if they're frozen out of the cabinet. I think many of them are in the cabinet. Mm. And I think ideology becomes important. And go through labor, communist. Trade and industry, communist. Science and technology, communist. A finance ministry, a deputy, communist. Mm. The communists have been catapulted into a position where they've essentially captured the cabinet. Mm. And if succession goes from deputy to minister and Tito Mboweni steps down, that's largely complete. And the ideology they pursue of national democratic revolution, that the state should dispossess the prosperous and should direct economic activity, has consequences that are well understood.
Mm.
And one of those consequences is that you're not going to attract investment and you're not going to grow the economy. Mm. And this isn't not known. I think Mr. Malema said last year, you must prepare yourself for the pain that comes with the revolution. The revolution doesn't make you rich immediately at all. Your life will first get worse. And part of getting worse and not growing and not having more entrepreneurship is that the government runs out of money. Let's simplify the analysis. You don't get investment, you don't grow, your money is going to run out. It's already happening. Debt to GDP, government debt, has more than doubled in a decade. And the budget deficit, which is the difference between what the government spends and it earns, is sitting at levels that we last saw at the end of the apartheid era, when South Africa was a pariah state in the world. And we record those figures today in an era when emerging markets are leading rates of global economic growth. So you run out of money. And when you run out of money as a government, what do? You've got four options. One is you can steal the money. And you can steal the money through nationalizing private savings, prescribed assets.
Yep.
You can force pension funds to invest in government agricultural cooperatives or in Eskom. And that's already on the table. And it's been put on the table in a particular way by people as sound relatively in the greater scheme of things as Enoch Godongwana. Mm. So there's one option. And I think they will go to that option. And at a breakfast meeting this morning, we discussed this with some journalists. And they said, really? And the one chap made the point and said, but they've already done it.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, the precedent is there. It's a massive pot of money, the pension funds and savings of South Africans. And do you suppose that running out of money, a communist cabinet is actually going to say, no, we shouldn't touch that. We should do something else. Of course not. Number one, you steal it.
Mm.
Number two is you manufacture it through quantitative easing. Mm. You type the money into your balance sheet, or you print it and throw it out of a helicopter. And separate from Gabriel, whoever he's been talking to at the central bank, a central bank person of some seniority said to me last year, his great fear is helicopter policy, which he said is putting money in a helicopter and throwing it out of the door in the hope that this puts down any sort of social uprising, whatever the case may be. And now you get the comment of the barbarians at the gate.
Mm.
That comment, by the way, that's an appeal for help.
Mm.
And Ramaphosa didn't go and back his man. He was wishy-washy dithering and sounded far more like, we are open to this.
Mm.
So you can print the money, and the consequence is economic collapse, very high inflation, and what goes with it, Ian has warned. The third thing that you can go and do is that you can borrow the money. So you can go to the IMF and they can give you the money and it'll come with conditions. You have to introduce certain reforms. But are these chaps who are going to be inclined to go to sort of the Western world hat in hand and say, sorry, we've actually screwed it up. Will you please bail us out? And yes, you may write the budget speech. Yeah. I mean, you've got to be super naive to think this is the natural evolution. So you've got other financiers. You've got the Russians, for example. They'd be very interested. And you've got the Chinese, and you know that we're developing some interesting views on the Chinese, and they're not all bad news. So you can steal it, you can make it, you can borrow it. The next thing that you can do is you can actually grow the economy. But to do that, you need to introduce structural reform that attracts investment, and there's very little sign of that in the environment around us. These are the consequences. They're born of an ideology, and the momentum behind that ideology is building very quickly.
And I like the fact that you introduced the idea of ideology, because I really want us to just quickly speak to it, and I'll come back to other talking points now. A lot of people look at the show, watch the show, they listen to us sort of go on these issues, but they just don't get why we're perceptively so negative, and why? Because, the mainstream media is just wonderful at the moment. They're saying, look, give him time, he's going to find his stride. But they don't understand that there is an ideology behind this that prompts the bad decisions. The National Democratic Revolution is that ideology, that socialist, status-leaning ideology that drives this, isn't it?
Yeah, you need to understand why. And why you need to understand the ideology. A very good place to start. We did a great launch of the book last night. Absolutely. In Pretoria. Anthea Jeffrey, People's War, begins to create the context. And if you keep asking the question why, we've spoken about it here before, go and read Anthea's book. You'll begin to understand quite a lot.
And just to speak to that, to the book, I think, and a problem that the ANC has, when the National Democratic Revolution was getting its way going in the 80s, one of the explicit strategies was for the ANC to play down its communist roots as well as its socialist and communist utopian end goal. Because most South Africans are not down with that, and the Institute's polling shows that most South Africans remain not down with it. They don't like radical economic transformation. They don't like the NDR. They don't like nationalizing all of the things that they prefer to grow jobs. The thing is, when your core policy, the sort of background idea behind all of the public ideas that you put forward, is, look, we need to fake it a little bit. We need to sound moderate some of the time. We need to sound pragmatic some of the time. Then even when genuine moderates come to the table, even when Mandela goes to Davos and comes away understanding why it's important not to nationalize lands, mines, and banks, even when members of the ANC cabinet today understand why we need to grow our way out of the hole rather than beg, steal, or
borrow, essentially.
We're not going to borrow, unfortunately, from the right people to borrow from. Even when they do understand that and they say it, it's hard to think why the ANC should believe itself, because it knows that there's this program. It still knows that there's this program because it still talks at every one of its conferences about needing to continue and pursue the National Democratic Revolution. It knows not to take that too seriously. And I think that also can, the sort of good cop, bad cop game that you end up playing is bad cop Ace Magashule saying, we need to do this now. And then good cop Ramaphosa saying, we need to do this. We just don't need to do it right now.
Yeah, and you
and
get
so
that.
You can't escape the perpetual cycle.
Yeah, here is I mean, just to add to the chronology of events of the week, this is Alex Mashilo. He's the head of communications and spokesperson for the Communist Party. This morning, he says that in his intervention this week, the governor of the bank, who said that we won't go this way, did not rule out the purchase of government securities by the bank. That's a nice way of saying printing money and manufacturing it. Now, Kanyahu did rule it out, I think. Mm. And this is him fighting back. Now, also in a very recent engagement with a person around this sort of thing, the person said, but these guys, the communists, they're not Zuma's allies. These are Ramaphosa's allies.
Yeah.
And we say, exactly. It's what we stop seeing the world through Zuma bad and Ramaphosa good, and Ramaphosa's defeated the Zumas and now everything's going to come right. On state capture and so on, to a certain extent, maybe yes, give the credit for that. But on ideology, a blind spot for so many analysts, this is Ramaphosa's camp speaking.
Franz, there's another element to this, and I'll come to you too, Ian. When you speak about the common analysis you get, you know, there is a lot of seeing the hole in the barn door, but not the actual barn door itself. You'll hear things, for example, like, oh, you know, it's just a few things that need to be done and we're on the right track. If you just, open up the much delayed radio frequency spectrum, for example, or if you break up Eskom and you sell some SOEs, et cetera, et cetera, everything will be fine. But there's a much deeper requirement for reform, Franz, isn't there?
Yeah, well, we wrote a note about it in the newspaper this morning. Yep. That yeah, all good ideas. But the economy didn't contract by 3.2% in the quarter because of spectrum that hadn't been awarded. And the economy didn't contract because Eskom's structure was somehow wrong. There's an enormous elephant standing in these debates, and no one's willing to confront it, and they pick rather peripheral issues. All good ideas. We probably should do some of them and not all of them. But why this great reluctance to actually confront the heart of the issue, the core of the thing? Is it because it reveals that vote for Cyril, the long game, the new dawn, was actually a lot of nonsense.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult once you've climbed onto that wagon to jump off, particularly in the full face of the public glare.
Mm. Ian, I'm going to come back to the data as we look to sort of move towards the tail end of our conversation. We've seen other data sets come out, you know, not maybe as recently, but, you know, unemployment, for instance, creeping up, and that seems to be the trend now that we're experiencing. We've been having a conversation here about the sorely needed reform that can actually begin to address these issues. Your reading of the unemployment numbers in conjunction, of course, with the GDP numbers. And the GDP numbers are also quite interesting when you break them down as to some of the sectors that really took a hit. Sure. That tells a real story, Ian, doesn't it?
Yes, it does indeed. What's the real core of this problem? Confidence. No, lack of confidence. Where do we see that? There's lack of fixed capital investment. What's that in simple terms? There are no new factories being built. There's no new orders for new machinery to be installed. There are no more jobs being created. We haven't got job creation, which is one of the requirements we have. We've got job destruction. Just look at the unemployment rate. And if we carry on like this, and there's no new factories, no new employment opportunities, we're going to have greater unemployment. And I think that is almost unavoidable in the near term, the next few months. Going to get worse, not before it's get better, it's going to get worse, and then it'll get worse still if we carry on with the sort of policies that Francis suggested the Communist Party could lead us into. And I'd like to point out one example. Argentina was mentioned, and remember that famous song, "Not for Me, Argentina."
Right.
You know why? Because the country went bust. They had unemployment in, I was going to say three digits, that's almost impossible. but they had massive unemployment, they had no growth, no activity, and really social upheaval. Eventually you had riots in the streets. That should be avoided at all costs. Surely government can see it. The answer seems to be apparently not, or they don't care.
No. It's not they can't see it. They can see it. I assure you they can see it. They see it. And it's not either that they don't care. They're very worried about the consequences.
Let me show it.
No. this is a theme repeats itself through my day. There's quite a good understanding of the consequences. And there's quite a lot of fear about where this leads, protest, diminishing voter support. Our analysis will be accepted. But for all of that, there's no willingness to change. And if you can try and go along with what I'm trying to bring across, you can understand what's going to happen next. And why not? Why, if the evidence, Ian, shows you this and you believe it, and if the consequences will be bad for you and you accept that, why do you not change? There's only one explanation left. It's ideology.
It's ideology. And there's just this really bizarre thing where when there is someone who sounds like an ideological moderate or an ideological reformer inside of the ANC speaks, everyone outside of the ANC believes that person to be speaking for the ANC and to be speaking accurately for him or herself. The question is, what do people inside the ANC think? I'm not talking about ANC voters. I'm talking about people, those 4,000 delegates that meet at the national conference, people in the National Executive Council. What do they think? Do they think, here we have a genuine ideological reformer, someone who really wants to look past race and get over the utopian communist dream? If they thought that, then you would see a genuine fight. If they think, okay, maybe this person is just singing the same old tune that we need to sing now and then to soften the pill to get the country to swallow the communist project, then you'll get these sort of fake fights where we agree ultimately on what we need to do. We need to nationalize the Reserve Bank. We agree ultimately on what we need to do. We need to nationalize all land. But you have the one side saying we must do it now, we must do it chaotically, and you've got the other side saying, no, we must do it by the book, and we need to make sure it doesn't hurt food security and it doesn't hurt the economy and it doesn't hurt the rand. So let's just wait for that kind of to happen. Mm-hmm. The fake fights indicate that the ANC doesn't believe itself, even in the few moments mm-hmm. when it does sound like an ideological reformist agenda is coming through. But everyone else does believe it. And that's a crisis. If real pressure is going to be applied to the ANC, it's going to be because everyone else stops being so ready to believe it when there's just a smattering of words and starts to only believe it when there's genuine, deep, and profound policy reform. And short of that, the pressure must win to
Chaps,
overcome it.
We've been almost skirting around the issue, alluding it to quite constantly in this conversation, this talk of reform. We don't mean reform in how it's maybe being posited in other new spaces. And I want us to talk to it because here's the hypothetical. I'm a chap in a Mlazi township. I live in a shack. I do not have an income. I'm despondent. I've been trying to look for work. I cannot find anything that just gets a foot in the door for me, even if it isn't at the quote-unquote minimum wage. What needs to happen to get me from that position to at least having some form of income that allows me to build the savings to buy the options like better healthcare, better education?
No, it's exactly the way to put the question. And we ourselves haven't been good enough at framing it that way. Number one, repeal race-based empowerment policy. Absolutely. It is seen as a tax on investment and job creation, disincentive to investment. Replace the basis of the policy race with established socioeconomic disadvantage, and put in place the schooling, the entrepreneurial, etc. climate that can allow poor people to ascend to the middle classes. Number one. Short of that, I don't think, just that, South Africa can try to compete with emerging market growth rates. The second thing that needs to be done is to repeal a lot of labor market regulation and legislation to price poor people into jobs. The great bulk of the unemployed have not completed high school. In an economy with a structure of GDPs turned over decades against primary and secondary industries, you need to abandon ideas of decent work, of minimum wages, of a state-directed labor market, and realize that we need to start championing job creators at any price, not so that some poor chap is exploited for the rest of his life. Initially, he may be. It's the hard reality of it. We're not going to pretend it's not the case. But in getting some job, two things happen. One, the dignity of being able to start to look after your family, and perhaps you can learn something.
Yep.
What you couldn't learn because you were a victim of South Africa's school system. And in time, if you work really hard, maybe your earned income will rise to compete with your welfare income and later exceed it. So labor market regulation. And number three, Ian said, certainty. You're not going to commit money to South Africa if the government suggests that it might one day try and take that money away. It's again, let's make it simple. It doesn't work because there are other parts of the world where governments don't threaten that and you can go to them. There's a I think it's The Economist now recently about employment. That for much of the world, unemployment is no longer an issue.
Yeah, it's not.
Yes.
It's not. We're unique.
Mm.
And South Africans don't appreciate that. Unemployment rate officially of almost 30%. Mm. I mean, the other parts of the world, there's shortages of people to work.
And
so empowerment, labor, and take expropriation off the table in all its facets. Do that, and South Africa is then in a position to start to drive the growth curve upwards to reach our country's great and undoubted potential.
I just want to add something on security, keeping it back in Umlazi.
Mm.
There's security from a macro investor's point of view. You know, you're sitting in England and you've got a lot of money, where you're going to send it. But there's also security from that guy in Umlazi's point of
view.
I make some money, I work hard, and then what happens? Exactly. If my TV gets stolen and I report it, is anything going to happen about that? If I buy new school uniforms for my kids and on the way back from school, they get their shoes get stolen off of their feet and I report it, is something going to happen about that? If working class people, if unemployed people manage to break into the working class and they're not protected by the, if their wealth is not secured, then it also doesn't work. Security needs to be a blanket thing. It needs to be hard and it needs to be done.
And we've had this conversation, Gabriel, haven't we, around the idea, because that's a matter of property rights. And,
Yes. You
know, a lot of people, when you talk about property rights, they just think, oh, it's just the land debate. No.
No.
It's the idea that someone can own something that they've worked hard for and know that it's protected either A, by themselves having the means to protect it, or B, the state playing its actual damn job, which is to protect property rights, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's I think that if you look up and down the South African economy, you find that people have to bear the costs of their own protection.
Mm.
And that does hit poor people the hardest.
Absolutely.
If you know, I was back in KZN last week, and there I drove past the same two guys who, one worked as a factory worker, you know, in an exploitative system. They did. One worked as a factory worker, the other one worked as a security guard. Throughout their lives, they saved money, they managed to send their kids to school, and they managed to save up enough to buy 20, 30 cattle and a fence. And they put it around a bit of the homeland where they came from. And then the fence was stolen, they reported to the police. Nothing happened. The cattle started getting stolen. They reported to the police. Nothing happened. Now they have nothing because nothing happened, excepting for a monthly government grant that is very hard. And where's the dignity in that? I think the fundamental rethink that we need to have is that poor black people can only get ahead by people sharing with them.
Mm.
Sharing is nice. Share with your family, share with your friends. When you go to church, share whatever. Poor black people are going to get ahead by adding value.
Absolutely.
By working. By doing the same thing that all human beings do when they want to grow and prosper, and that is to add value to other people's lives, and in exchange for
Absolutely.
That, get wealth that they can accumulate and that is secured by themselves and by a state that protects them from thugs, thieves, whether they're wearing suits and they want to steal your money by printing extra rands out until the rands in your pocket mean nothing, or whether they want to come with a gun and take the 20-year-old car that you managed to scrape enough shekels together to buy.
And now what you're told is that the way to get over this, past this, is by nationalizing the Reserve Bank, pension funds, and expropriating property without compensation. It's bullshit and must be called out as bullshit.
And it's theft. It's pure theft. Because a lot of people don't realize that inflation is just another way of being taxed. Because someone has to pay that money. Ian, as I move towards perhaps final thoughts, unless there's other things you guys want to chat about, I'm open to that. The chaps have set out a very real reform agenda. But I want us to sort of speak to the macro climate. And you brought it up, the issue of confidence. The international investor community is looking at us in a very much more dubious light at the moment. How do we rebuild that confidence amongst the international community for South Africa to be an investment haven once again?
I think what we have to do is start at foundation level. Forget about free tertiary education. That doesn't provide jobs, actually. What we need is to have the ability to put a roof over your head. For somebody to say to his mother, with whom he stays under the kitchen table, I know how to lay a straight row of bricks. Give me enough money to build a room, and he'll have his whole family in there. In no time, the neighbor will see that and say, gee, can you do that for me? Yes, and they'll work together. It's about partnerships and about seeing these partnerships being productive. In another short time, the next person will say, gee, can I join you? And they have somebody to push the wheelbarrow to mix the cement. Start at grassroots level. We're not doing that. Mm. And I think if that is seen to be happening, if one asks the laborers, what do you want? You see, and you say, and he'll say, you'll say, no, that's an unfair pay level to be made. I think what we should say is ask the worker, hold out one loaf of bread in front of a number and see what the minimum wage is. Mm. We've got to get used to the fact that half a loaf is better than no bread. Let's be seen to be making a start in that way. Instead of, rules that we have, the government rules that we have, pricing that whole sector out of work opportunities. If that is seen, it will be recognized. It will attract foreigners to come and build their factories here, and that will get the growth phase going.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, final thoughts. Also tie in maybe what people can look forward to in terms of your writing, upcoming or planned fronts.
Yeah, Sunday and the Daily Friend, we pick up on cabinet and the central bank a little bit more. And I think, you know, there's also a positive here, Tsikhle. A very good thing began to happen towards the end of Mr. Zuma's era, in that previously very naive analysts began, and commentators began, to say that maybe here is a problem. Mm. And they diagnosed the problem as corruption and the like around the ANC, but at least they diagnosed it, a problem. And that was a very good thing, and it created a lot of pressure on Mr. Zuma, and eventually he departs the scene. Just in the last week, you know, and we become quite good at these things, the sort of canary in the coal mine sometimes that we are. And we speak to so many groups and organizations. There's enormous disappointment at what has happened around the cabinet announcement, and now this stuff, and now the dithering of Mr. Ramaphosa. And I think where it's going to lead very quickly is a reassessment of what people had been told to believe. And that creates an opportunity. And the opportunity is to identify that in addition to the terrible corruption of the Zuma era, there was another issue, and that was leftist ideology. Mm. And we need to defeat them both if our country is to reach its great potential.
Yeah, just to roll on with that kind of positive point. Last night I did an interview about BEE on the SABC, or a debate rather, for half an hour. And the way the debate was framed was very much that BEE has failed. And I think a couple of years ago, it was impossible to come to a debate with that as the starting common premise. Now, the problem was there was a lot of like, okay, BEE failed. What we need to do is more of it, or what we need to do is BEE with different people. So this personnel, keep the policy as it is, but change the personnel, which is like a classic South African issue to get through. But at least we started from the premise that it failed. And at least when you look at our surveys of most South Africans, they understand. I mean, we have 80%. Our surveys indicate 80% of people think that appointments should be based on merit. And then of that, a majority think that there should be training advantages given to people who are disadvantaged. And disadvantaged, not race as a proxy, real race. Yeah. And I mean, because the real question is, how do you think you can have a BEE policy that doesn't squeeze the economy and reward black people who grew up, went to private schools, went to nice universities, got flown around the world, their parents are already in parliament or in government or in big business? How are they not going to be the winners in that winner-take-all?
Those closest to proximity to privilege, if you will.
That question is just becoming more and more obvious, and I think it does offer a potential breaking point for the clogged-up stasis of ideology.
No, you must have no doubt that it does. Our sort of eminence grise here, John Cain Berman, said that apartheid ended in the late 1960s when the government agreed that the Springboks could play an all-black team that included Maoris. And John's point was that when ideologically driven regimes compromise on the core of the ideology, in this case separate development, keep them apart, it sets in motion, as the pressure builds, a chain of events that will see it compromise further and further. Now, John recalls that the Jaap Marais, the former leader of the Herstichte Nationale Partij, so we're talking about pretty dogmatic, warned Foster about this rugby decision and saying, if you do this, one day a black man will marry your daughter and sit next to you in Parliament. And Marais was right that when you compromise on the core of the thing, you begin to unravel it. And it will unravel more and more and more. It might take a very long time. It might be a lot of pain and suffering to get there, as indeed was the case for South Africa from the late 60s until the transition of the 1990s. But there can be no marker that is more critical as a nascent little indicator of potential reform than when you compromise on the core of the ideology. And when the state broadcaster, because that's what it is, has a show that invites this chap onto it, and the premise of the show is how BE has failed. Wow, there's actually a lot more changing in our society than would meet the eye to many observers. Mm.
Chaps, let me say thank you very much. Ian, thank you for joining us on this episode. Guys, thank you both.
Thank you, Sid.
And thank you for continuing to watch the show, support the show, and be a part of the show. We do read some of your comments. I can't read all of them. But we really do appreciate the involvement that you guys show in the show. And I encourage you to involve yourself a bit more by supporting the show. Become a friend of the IRR. This is our crowdfunding campaign where we look to you to support the work that we do here. You can do this by becoming by SMSing your name to 32823. An SMS will cost you R1, and terms and conditions do apply. But hey, maybe you are a millennial or a new kid on the block and you don't know what SMSs are. You're like, SMS, what is that? Then find us online at irr.org.za/join, where you can sign up a monthly debit order there to join the other South Africans who are donating between 70 and 90 rand a month. And we are using those funds to get into the battle of ideas, to influence fellow South Africans like you and give them the tools, the arguments, if you will, to begin to push back against the bad ideas that we see in society. Guys, remember to like, comment, share, and subscribe to the YouTube channel, both on the IRR YouTube channel and the Big Daddy Liberty YouTube channel, where you'll find all our shows playlisted and categorized there. And again, lastly but not least, hit that bell notification so that every time an episode comes out, you'll know exactly what's happening there. And one more thing, today the podcast of the show will come out. You'll find that by searching the IRR page on IONO.com. Guys, thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next week on The Daily Friend.